Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm delighted today to be talking to Robert Edmund Cotter. Robert is the author of John Senex, 1718 to 1755, Methodism, Moravianism, and the Rise of Evangelicalism, just published with Routledge. It's a fine book, fascinating book, in their new series, Routledge Studies in Evangelicalism. I'm Crawford Gribben, and I'm delighted to welcome you back to the show. Bob, it's great to talk to you today. Can you tell us before we start a little bit about your background?
Okay. Initially, I was a journalist, and I did a DPhil in Oxford on 19th century literature. And then I taught for many years in a grammar school in Belfast, French and German particularly. Thereafter, I was ordained as a church parliament minister after attending sessions in Dublin for a number of years. And that was in 2005, and I combined that with teaching for about another 7 years when I decided I would devote myself to ministry and also to additional studies. So I got very interested in revivals because I saw working in the inner city that revival was necessary.
Thanks, Bob. And in terms of John Senex in particular, tell us a little bit about him. Who he was, very briefly, when he lived, what his significance was, and perhaps how you got interested in him individually.
Okay, yes, it was, I stumbled upon him. I was reading around, trying to further my knowledge of history of religion, and I stumbled first across the Pietists, which worked then through Zinzendorf. I was fascinated by Zinzendorf and all that he had achieved. And then in due course, I came to John Senex, and he particularly fascinated me because there seemed to be a number of connections with my own biography, I suppose, in that he had worked in Ireland. He worked down the road here in Ballymena. In fact, I could walk from here to where he lived during his first period of time in Ireland in 1848-49. And also, as a journalist, initially, I was fascinated that he had worked in Germany, had two lengthy spells in Germany, and as I further discovered, knew a fair bit of German, both to read and to a less extent to write. And yeah, because he was a charismatic figure who was a great preacher, and he came from an Anglican position like myself, and worked with worked with a number of the greats, and held his own.
And when you say a number of the greats, you're talking about the Wesley brothers, Whitfield, Zinzendorf, you mentioned before. One of the things that's really striking about the book is you talk about new sources that you discovered, which relate to some of these relationships, don't they?
Yeah, I think there were two places where I found particularly good sources. In the Little Moravian Archives in London, Muswell Hill, a great resource for anyone who's interested in lots of things happening and not just Moravianism throughout sort of 18th century, 19th century onwards. And above all, I would say in the Herrnhut Saxony archives, which opened up a bit more after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989-1990, which were hidden behind the Iron Curtain, if you will, and which many scholars probably didn't have access to. And things were, well, real gems of things were hidden there, particularly correspondence between Zinzendorf and Senec himself. And that led to quite exciting days as I unearthed them.
Thanks, Bob. Now, one of the other things you tell us in the book is a little bit about Senec's context. So obviously, he grows up in England, he travels to Ireland, he travels to Germany. He's part of a movement, becomes part of a movement, the Moravian movement, which within a very few short years has stations around the Caribbean and South Africa, you mentioned, elsewhere. Tell us a little bit about what makes Senec's context so important for understanding him.
Well, it's a fascinating question. He grew up in a time when there seemed to be a lot happening. There was a lot of movement, a lot of oppression, and a lot of fanaticism, you may call it, enthusiasm. I suppose a lot of it came from the continent, but it wasn't just the continent. There was a lot happening within Anglicanism, a lot happening as a throwback to Puritanism. There were a number of strands just came together at a very interesting time. And Senec, who really didn't know what direction his life should take, he tried various avenues, and none of them worked out. But it started, I think, in his childhood. His mother was very staunchly, seriously minded, religious in this non-juror Anglican sense. And his grandfather apparently hailed from Bohemia. And Senec was also very interested in reading about religious history and informing himself. He also got very depressed as a teenager in probably one of the times when people often wonder what their life's going to be. But he took it from the point of view of religion. And when he discovered the writings of Whitfield, he was off. It was as if there was something he could get enthused about. And the revival was sort of tailor-made for him. Not that he knew he could preach or knew how he could be involved. Again, those things happened by chance, and it all seemed to fall into his lap in many ways. But he had done a lot of quiet reading and very serious engagement with the Bible and with lots of other reading, which I would love to find exactly what. There are only a few things that we can pinpoint. I'd love to have access to his actual library. But
thanks, Bob. Now, one of the things you talk about in the book is that it's process of formation. He starts out as an Anglican. His mother, as you say, is in contact or part of this non-juring tradition, a very particular kind of Anglicanism, very politically driven kind of Anglicanism in a way, very, very conservative. He starts out there, he moves through Whitfield, all the energy and excitement of Whitfield's preaching. You tell us in the book that Whitfield effectively deputizes him, doesn't he, when Whitfield heads off to Georgia, I think it is, or Connecticut and Massachusetts, was it, in America?
Yeah.
That's right. And Senec is left really with the tabernacle in London to look after and elsewhere. But you also talk in the book not only about these very strong Calvinist influences in his life, he also has a relationship with Wesley's that's complicated. He's a growing fascination with Moravian blood and wounds piety, maybe you could explain that. But he also has an interest in Catholic mysticism and even monasticism. So how do we begin to explain his formation?
Well, it's certainly very disparate, very eclectic. And he read widely. I suppose from a point of view of someone who was an autodidact, you can read more widely. You're not constrained by your teachers. You're not in a dissenting college. You're not in an Anglican seminary or elsewhere. You're not in a Catholic seminary for that being. So he just he read what he enjoyed and what appealed to him. And clearly there was a reclusive part of his nature as well, which found monasticism appealing that appealed to the way he liked to be serious about what he was doing and to regulate his life, because one of the other aspects of him, I suppose, was that he felt he needed discipline. Of course, he had the guiding hand of his mother, which was a very firm hand throughout his life, right to the very end. it was the familiar battle, I suppose, of finding his own way and yet, well, kowtowing or deferring to his mother along the way. So, yeah, he discovered emblematic books of Hermann Hugel, for example. That's the one which is mentioned specifically in his letter to Zinzendorf, written when he was in the Moravian Center in Herrnhag. And we know that accompanied him throughout his life from his late teens onwards. So pictures, meaningful mystical pictures as ways of engagement with texts, and what I call picking up a theme from someone who'd written about William Blake, iconomysticism, is an underplayed aspect of Senec's interests and personality and his religiosity. We often see him, and he's often presented as the preacher, and certainly that was a very important thing about him. But my studies have shown that he was much more than that, and there was more complexity, more variety, and more interest, from my point of view, in someone who had a very varied upbringing and religious formation. Now, the Moravians happened to be in England because they were wanting to expand their own network in a transatlantic sense. And, of course, London was a great metropole for that. And they happened to be around in England when the revivals were kicking off. Not that the Moravians were necessarily terribly keen on revivals, because Zinzendorf himself had lots of qualms about mass meetings and the kind of mixed motives that people might want to come along and listen to the likes of Whitfield for. But he couldn't, shall we say, let go the opportunity to establish a foothold in London, because they were coming through there all the time anyway. And not only that, but within Anglicanism, within this very evangelical, very keen branch of Anglicanism, there's a lot of interest in mysticism, a lot of interest in new practices and new beliefs, and the strange, shall we say, resuscitated almost late medieval ideal deism that I refer to in the book, particularly to do with blood and wounds mysticism.
You mentioned, Bob, that Senec gets known as a preacher. He's also known as the preacher, in fact, as the apostle of Ireland. So talk us through that. How does he get interested in Ireland, and how does he become so prominent among Moravians in Ireland, while also being a little bit cautiously treated by those in the leadership of the movement?
Yeah, well, Senec had already gained a great reputation by his preaching in various parts of England, particularly in the western part of England, in Wiltshire, but also in London. So he was in the capital, he got noticed, and if you're associated with Whitfield, you're going to get noticed. If you're associated, well, certainly in an early stage with Wesley, although there was a falling out there within a couple of years in any case, but a big following and an itinerant ministry, which meant that he was known to large groups of people, hit the headlines, and he had been taught by Whitfield how to capitalize on that and to publicize it. And so he was publishing hymns, 5 editions of hymns in 4 years. It's incredible. Such a young man. The confidence even to do that for someone who was not university trained. So, he was sought out by people who were fascinated by his preaching, and probably in many ways by his orthodox theology in one sense, and yet that was balanced out by the strange language that he used. So there's a mixture of the exotic from the mystical language of blood and wounds, but tied in with a very very strongly Calvinist orthodox theology associated with Whitfield. Remember, Senec also had been a great defender of Whitfield, and it helped to establish his own lines of theological thinking as he had to defend himself against the very combative John Wesley. Very combative and very combative John Wesley. He's not going to let anything past him that didn't suit him. So anyway, some Baptists, as it turned out, came from Dublin. Heard Cernick speaking, I think it was in London, when they were there on a visit, made the offer to him, well, could you come over to speak to us in Dublin? The people there would love to hear you. Cernick said, yeah, that's fine. We'll see if we can arrange it. But he was in the middle of shall we say, trying to get rid of his responsibilities to Whitfield by looking after the Tabernacle Society, which had become rather fractious, and then drifting much more to the Moravians, whom he probably over-idealized at this time in his state of mind. He sought membership of them formally in December of 1745, but he had been, shall we say, flirting with them for a number of years before that. So this invitation came in the autumn of 1745. He wasn't able to get over to Ireland because when he arrived at Holyhead, as often happens, I'm sure, it was too rough, and he couldn't hang around. His means were limited. So, and also the Moravians were wanting to send him over to Germany. It expressed an interest in learning more about the continental Moravianism. So they packed him off in awful weather again to the continent in old style calendar and Christmas Eve. Actually, what a way to spend your Christmas over to from Harwich. Through the Dutch ports to the German centers near Frankfurt, and it was there that he was interviewed, shall we say, at length for several months, and to some extent found wanting. I think, as I say in the book at one point, if Sinzendorf has way, Cernick would not have been touched by any kind of barge pull because he was far too un-Moravian in his style of preaching, far too Methodist still. He was a guy who was used to speaking to huge crowds, and I imagine Sinzendorf wondered whether he would be able to work in the much more intimate religiosity that he favored.
It's a very striking discussion in the book, actually, Cernick's decision to move from what we might describe as mass evangelistic events into a religious community that by this stage had a very distinctive history, didn't it? And it had gone through some trials and troubles of its own. You mentioned before that he had maybe idealized them a little bit. So talk us through what Cernick's experience would have been that December, January, as he tracks out from England across into Central Europe. What's it? What's he going to experience? What's he going to discover there?
Well, as I say in my version of Cernick's diary, which was published in the Journal of Moravian Studies there in last year, he was on a journey, both a physical journey and a journey of discovery of his own way in life. He had been very actively involved, probably outside his comfort zone, by looking after a very, as I've said, very fractious Calvinistic Methodist community, and he was not great at man management. He was much better at evangelizing, either mass or in small groups. So when he heads to the continent here, he's there with just a very few Moravians. We're not clear exactly how many. It might have been just half a dozen, but certainly Paul Weiss was with him, a man that he had met in London. And bear in mind that Sinzendorf had set up a worshipping community for the Moravians in London, the Fetter Lane group, all expanded into its own worshipping community because, I imagine, the Moravians who were going through London heading to the colonies wanted to have somewhere where they could worship in their own way rather than have to just attend Anglican churches, although Sinzendorf, of course, insisted they also did that to keep themselves in with the hierarchy. So when Cernick goes through Holland, he meets various Moravian families and contacts there, and he's impressed by the orderliness of their lives, by the way they relate to one another, by the intensity of their religion. And that's totally different from what he had experienced in England, where people, you know, seem to get so much more worked up about their own opinions and making sure that they asserted themselves and convinced other people that they were right. The Moravians were a much quieter, much more settled, more biddable in many ways. I'm sure there are cultural differences. They're coming through Lutheranism, Pietism, or whatever, whereby it is a much quieter, much more intimate, but much more all-pervading and all-consuming form of religion. Your life is what you believe, and your relationship to Jesus is not, for them, wasn't just something reserved for a Sunday or for parading before other people. So when he does arrive in the Moravian Center in Marienborn, particularly there near Frankfurt, he is, he's bowled over by the sheer intensity, the variety of it, by the huge range of different nationalities, because Zinzendorf had deliberately tried to be creating another one of his Philadelphian communities there for that. He deliberately collected people from different countries, but they were also attracted to it because there was a lot going on there. It became a real magnet for anyone who was wanting to see where it was happening. And so Senec was bowled over both by the variety and the intensity, but also, again, by the sheer deeply Christian and spiritual way that people related to one another. He was at a low ebb psychologically. He was probably depressed and exhausted because he had been very highly involved in England. He probably felt a bit out of place. He felt that he was almost a bit of a fraud, because these people seem to be the genuine article, despite all his evangelism, despite all the great work that he had done, and he could be very proud of it. But he felt he could be very proud of it. But the Moravians, I think, the experience of living with them began to make him think, well, should I be so proud of it? Is all that I've done up to now really worth anything? These people have got something so special. These people live, they relate to one another in ways that I never imagined people could relate. This is what I want to have, and yet I don't feel worthy of it. And the other thing I point out in that article was that he was wrestling with what the Moravians called his reasoning. In other words, he was constantly trying to justify himself, constantly trying to think, well, you know, what have I done? What could I do now rather than leaving it to the work of the Holy Spirit, rather than quietly waiting, as the Moravian idea was at this time, with their stillness idea, waiting for God to take action rather than actively wanting to move on and decide, well, what decision will I take? What have I learned here? How can I run with it? So he was not a patient man. Again, probably he was so hyperactive in the revivals, maybe a lot, he was surrounded by a lot of hyperactive people, Whitfield, etc., the Wesleys certainly too, and yet he comes to this enclave in Europe where it is overactive liturgically, but not in other senses. And so his mind needed to be quietened, but his spirit needed to be quickened.
That's fascinating, Bob. Now, you also mentioned in the book that as a preacher, it's very much formed by that English Methodist experience. And as a hymn writer, he's also deeply influenced by Charles Wesley. So he moves to Germany. He goes through this many months-long interview process he just described. But is he being invited to abandon his Methodist preaching and hymnic style, or is there a way that he can incorporate this with the new spiritual experiences and the new theological and mystical ideas that he's incorporating in this very distinctive European group?
Well, I think his hymn writing had already been changing under Charles Wesley. Well, the Wesleyans themselves were, of course, influenced by Lutheran practices. Hymns were the Lutheran preserve. And Wesley himself, when they were heading over to Georgia in their first trip, had been impressed by the Moravians singing these hymns during a storm and just leaving themselves to the will of God. And so that Lutheran, that Pietist, that Moravian tradition of hymn singing was very strong. And of course, Zinzendorf had introduced the Singstunde, the singing hour, as part of their daily liturgies. So they were very strong in music. Now, Senec had been writing his own hymns, and he'd been encouraged to, because everyone was writing hymns, I suppose, that wanted to make a name for themselves. And if you've got a colleague, friend, mentor like Charles Wesley, you're going to want to write hymns and test yourself in doing so. But having read through all of Senec's hymns collection, you're left wondering to what extent these would be congregational hymns or whether they would be more meditations or reflections for personal devotions, because a lot of them are unashamedly personal to Senec himself. They reveal someone who is searching for what God is doing in his life and what God is going to be doing soon. And a lot of them are, as I say in the chapter in Eschatology, are pointing to the meaning of the revivals. What is all this? How does all this hang together? Now, he doesn't use the academic vocabulary of eschatology or anything that would have been around and familiar to people who had been writing about this, pontificating about this for years, but still it's unmistakable in those hymns. And of course, he was also, when he became aware that there was a Moravian worship center in London, where he decided that he wanted to write hymns that would suit them. So he, having broken with the Wesleys in 1741, he could now do more what he wanted with his hymn writing, and he saw a customer base, shall we say, among the Moravians of people whom he was already attracted to, because, say, he found that same medieval blood and wounds mysticism through the Catholic Jesuit writers like Herman Hugo, and he wanted to write in that idiom, and he enjoyed writing in that idiom, and he was very skilled at writing in that idiom, whereas I imagine Charles Wesley quite often wanted to steer him off from that most of the time. So he found, I think, a vein which enabled his own religious questing and one which resonated with the Moravian fascination with, or you almost would say, obsession with blood and wounds vocabulary, terminology, as the, as I say at one point also in the book, the epistemology, the way of organizing their religious thoughts.
Bob, it has been great to talk to you today about your new book in the Rutledge Studies in Evangelicalism series, John Senec, 1718 to 1755, Methodism, Moravianism, and the Rise of Evangelicalism. And I strongly recommend it for anyone who's interested in 18th century evangelicalism. It's kind of an essential read, I think, and set an agenda for years to come. Before we wind up, Bob, can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on just at the moment?
Well, I haven't been able to find time just to go back to my historical studies on Senec. I am a church violin minister. I'm quite busy with looking after three parishes, and I'm also doing studies in health science, because I feel that I need to know about the kind of conditions that people are suffering from in my congregations. But having said that, I would be interested as a next stage to see how Senec was received by the Church of Ireland at the time that he was, that was 10 years pretty much, 9 years anyway, that he was in Ireland, because we only get from the literature Senec's view of how he related to the other religions. It would be nice to be able to come up with a more rounded view of how Senec was seen. Yeah, initially by the Church of Ireland, but also by the Roman Catholic constituency at the time, which is the largest one, of course. We read a lot about Senec having been chased by Roman Catholic mobs when he was in Dublin, for example, and by the priests warning off their parishioners from coming to hear him. But we also hear contravening evidence of other priests who are asking him, well, please come and speak to my people, or why don't you go to the west of Ireland? They're hungry for your kind of preaching. And, of course, I can imagine because of the blood and wounds, the mystical, the Jesuit-inspired imagery, at the very least, that this would resonate quite well with a Roman Catholic group listening to it, because we were at this point already into the Sacred Heart of Jesus theology, and there are lots of other reasons through many of the classic writers that were also read by the Wesleys and were also shared in that eclectic way by many of the great Protestant evangelicals.
Bob, thank you very much for your time today. It's been great to talk to you about your new book, and great to explore some of the context around it and to hear more about your future research. Thank you for your time, and thanks everyone else for tuning in today. It's been great to have you on New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network.